Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. And of course, we're recording on Tuesday morning, the day of the Michigan primary. I saw this wonderful story in the Times, and I wanted to share it with you because I, you know, billionaires have largesse. They give money. The Kochs have given money. You know, we know that. We know that a lot of, you know, Musk has given money. But there are some times when you see that there's a donation that makes you smile because there's no expectation except to do the right thing. Here's the title. $1 billion donation will provide free tuition at a Bronx medical school. Ruth Gottesman, a longtime professor at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, is making free tuition available to all students going forward. And I love the story. She's a 93-year-old widow of a Wall Street financier. She donated the largest charitable donation ever to an educational institution in the U.S. and probably the largest to a medical school. The fortune came from her late husband, David Gottesman, known as Sandy, who is a protege of Warren Buffett and has made an early investment in Berkshire Hathaway, the conglomerate Mr. Buffett built. The donation is notable not only for its staggering size, but also because it's going to a medical institution in the Bronx, the city's poorest bureau. The Bronx has a high rate of premature deaths and ranks as the unhealthiest county in New York. Over the past generation, a number of billionaires have given hundreds of millions of dollars to better-known medical schools and hospitals in Manhattan, the city's wealthiest borough. But the reason I love this is not only did Dr. Gottesman actually teach there, she taught at that school. So she knows the school. She's 93. Her 96-year-old husband died before her and said to her, do whatever you want that makes you happy with this money. And so she gave her name to the, she gave the money to the school. But this is the most important point. The name. Dr. Gottesman was reluctant to attach her name even to the donation. Nobody needs to know, she insisted. But then she went on to say, I will give this donation only on the agreement that you will never confer my name or anything related to my name to this school. And she wrote, we've got the best gosh darn name anyway. We've got Albert Einstein. You need nothing else. Oh, God, she taught there. It's a beautiful story about doing right with your money with no expectation except to do right. All right, joining us right now is the executive editor of the American Prospect. His name is David Dayan. David has an incredible reputation. He is the author of Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. He earned the Stubbs and Ida Turkle Prize. He was the winner of the 2021 Hillman Prize for Excellence in Magazine Journalism. And of course, being the commanding lead with the executive editor of the American Prospect, it has turned the American Prospect. It was always something I always sought out. But David, I need to tell you, I check it every single morning just to make sure I know what's going on. But the piece I wanted to share was really, really important because I don't think anybody quite understands what Joe Biden just did. And your piece was why 4 million student borrowers got debt relief. And this is the most important line. It's just a matter of Biden's education department fixing existing forgiveness programs that previous presidents failed to follow for decades. And this story, David, could go to everything, to earned income tax credits, to access to Medicaid, to access to student loans. And of course, what I kind of love is that when this money was then sent or this relief was informed of these students that they didn't have to pay back anymore, he also said, I hope this relief will at least give you a little help in being able to sort of manage and juggle your bills. So he took credit for this relief. He also gave them a note when they received notice of it. But this is not a new program. He didn't have to pull something out of the air. He didn't have to do something. All he had to do was look at what was already on the books and deliver it to people who actually would benefit from this relief. So welcome to the program, David, and talk to us a little bit about the buckets that he went to in order to provide this relief for students. And it was significant, but there was nothing new there. It was just connecting the dots.
That's right. So when we talk about Joe Biden and student loan relief, we talk typically about this big mass debt relief program that he tried to put in place and the Supreme Court blocked. So that would have taken out $10,000 for every student, $20,000 if they had a Pell Grant, for, you know, 40 million students with student loans. That was blocked by the courts, and they're now working on a more narrow form of that through a different authority. But the truth is that there are all sorts of student loan debt forgiveness programs that the government has put together since the 1960s for certain specialized categories. So if you, for example, have student loans and then you become totally or permanently disabled, a program that has been in place since 1965 says you get to discharge your federal student loans if you become totally disabled and are unable to work. And the problem was that borrowers had to affirmatively apply. They didn't know about the program. And so what Biden's education department did in that instance is he put together a data matching program. So if you are with the Social Security Administration and you're on disability, that data gets ported over to the education department and says, oh, you had a student loan. We're going to automatically forgive that student loan because that's what the law says you're supposed to do if you're totally and permanently disabled. So that's one of actually five separate examples of just fixing a program that was already in place to give students relief in specialized circumstances.
So we went back to the 1960s for this relief program. There are four other buckets. I want people to hear about these buckets. And then I'm going to tell you my reaction after reading your story, because I had so many light bulb moments, you would not believe it. So give us an example of some of the other things that we can do. So as people are complaining and bitching and moaning, oh, well, look what he's doing. And oh, he should be giving money to poor people. He should be giving. These were already on the books. They were there. People just didn't know. People didn't know how to access. They weren't informed. And so because of the lack of connection between the program and the dollars needed, people were being denied something they could have accessed years ago. That's the killer, David. But if nothing else, at least he made sure it happened now.
It's actually worse than they didn't know. I mean, that was sort of the case with the total and permanent disabled program. But in the case of a lot of these others, they did know about it. They applied for it. And they were just denied the relief that the government said they were supposed to get. So I'll give you some examples of that. The first one would be what is called borrower defense to repayment. And what that means is that if your school closes while you were receiving a loan to go to that school, or if your school defrauds you, which is the case with for-profit colleges, for example, that say, we're going to give you a diploma that you're going to be able to get a job from, and it turns out that diploma is completely worthless. In those cases, the borrower is supposed to be able to assert, my school defrauded me, my school closed when they were supposed to give me an education, I'm supposed to get forgiveness. And that's a requirement under the Higher Education Act of 1965. And the Obama administration, the Trump administration, they actually worked to delay and even just outright deny these requests. Under Betsy DeVos, she tried to shortchange defrauded students by changing the form of relief to making it only partial. And so what the Biden administration did is they said, we're going to make this a priority and we're going to process these borrower defense applications and we're going to get them out. And it turns out 1.3 million borrowers have benefited from $22.5 billion in debt relief just from that. So that's one batch. I talked about the total and permanent disability batch, which was another 500,000 borrowers and about $11.7 billion. Then we get to even bigger numbers. There's a program called Public Service Loan Forgiveness.
Oh, yeah, I'm familiar with that.
Congress put in place. It was signed by George W. Bush in 2007. And it says if you go work for government organizations, public defenders, if you go work as a teacher, you go work for a nonprofit organization in public service, if you pay your loans for 10 years, we're going to forgive the rest. That was the bargain that was made. So people signed up, said, I'm working in public service. I paid my loans for 10 years. Program started in 2007. It ended in, it didn't end, but the first batch of 10-year grantees was supposed to go out in 2017. That's the beginning of the Trump administration. Guess what? Nobody got their public service loan forgiveness. There were delays. There were servicer errors. There were just denials. And Biden came in, said, I'm going to fix this. And since Biden has come into office, about 790,000 borrowers have gotten $56 billion in debt relief just from the public service loan program, honoring what they promised. They promised that if you, played by the rules, worked in public service and paid your loans for 10 years, we're going to forgive them. So all the debt relief there is just following the promises of the program. So that's bucket number three. I actually have two more.
I love this. You keep going. You can't make me smile even more. Keep going.
Okay. There's two more. The first one is there's a separate set of repayment programs called income-driven repayment. And these started in the early 1990s. And depending on the program, if after 20 years of making payments, these payments are attached to your income. So if you make $30,000 a year, you pay a certain amount, a percentage of that in the student loan. If you make $50,000, you pay a little bit more, et cetera, et cetera. And if there's a balance after 20 years or 25 years, depending on the program, you're supposed to get that balance forgiven. Once again, people signed up, they played by the rules, they paid for 20 years or 25 years, they were supposed to get the rest forgiven. But it wasn't happening. Servicers were screwing up the paperwork. They were not counting payments to where they were supposed to go. So the Biden administration made a priority of fixing these administrative failures. And as a result, almost a million borrowers have received $45 billion in debt forgiveness. And now the most recent example, the fifth bucket, is just what happened about a week or so ago, where the Biden administration updated that forgiveness program and said, look, if you had less than $12,000 in loans and you go into this income-driven repayment program, after 10 years, we're going to forgive the whole thing. And what they said was, if you enter the program and you've already been paying for 10 years and initially you borrowed $12,000 or less, we will run the numbers and automatically forgive your loans. And that's what they announced yesterday, actually 6 months ahead of schedule. They said 153,000 people who follow that eligibility, who met that standard and have already paid for 10 years, they're going to have their balances automatically forgiven. And that's another $1.2 billion. So you add all this up and it's almost $138 billion just by making programs where promises were made work.
That aspect of this has not actually been reflected in most of the news stories. So I am beyond grateful, number one. Number two, I just want to go back to the one that you tweaked, where you said they had to wait from 20 years and they reduced it down to 10. What authority did they have to be able to sort of massage the numbers and reduce the 20 to 10? Because again, if there's a place where the Republicans will push back or somebody will push back, I have a feeling that that's the one that exhibits a bit of the greatest weakness. So I'm just trying to figure out under what authority could they actually make that go from 20 to 10?
Well, under the Higher Education Act, the Department of Education has the authority to determine how loans will be paid back to the federal government. Okay. And starting in 1992, they came up with this idea of, okay, we're going to tie these loan repayments to your income. Mm-hmm. And so that's been in place for over 30 years.
Okay.
And it has not been challenged in court at any point during that juncture. So what Biden did was he just said, okay, we've had this program in place for 30 years to use your income as the determinant of what your monthly payment is going to be, and then to forgive at the end of a certain period of time. We're just going to change those numbers. And so far, that was announced way back in 2022, and it was put in place last October. And to date, nobody has come forward to challenge that. So maybe it will happen. Maybe Republicans will figure this out and decide that that a program that's been in place since 1992 is suddenly unconstitutional. But for now, The administration has all the authority it needs to make changes to an income-driven repayment program.
So as I'm listening to you and I was reading your story, it reminded me of two different states. So I have a friend that used to work in New Hampshire as sort of in like sort of the low income welfare area. And then she moved to Humboldt County. And she said, you know what, Arnie, let me just tell you the difference between working in New Hampshire and working in Humboldt County. In New Hampshire, they didn't lift a finger if a program existed. You had to figure it out on your own. They weren't helpful. You had to negotiate. You had to find access to a computer. There was the idea that the program existed, but all the effort and all the burden was put on the person that should be able to access the healthcare program, whatever it is. She said in Humboldt County, what was so amazing to her was that they were told by their senior staff, we will figure out what program exists and we will get it to them. We will get it to them. It's a totally different mindset. The laws exist. The money is there. It's intended to go to these individuals. And you're acting like somehow these people have PhDs and computers and accountants and lawyers that can figure out exactly how to manipulate the system, but they don't. But they don't. And what I so love about your story is that these programs have been in existence for decades. The fact that they couldn't necessarily get to the people that really should have benefited from them is a pox on government. But you know what this reminds me of? This is what Republicans hated. Remember when they created something called motor voter? And that's what this reminds me of, because motor voter meant that you could register to vote at the same time you access government for some other reason, whether you were signing up for benefits or whatever. And so instead of having to go through a separate process to register to vote, motor voter existed. So what did my state do, David? They're one of the, I think, two states in the country that got out from motor voter because they didn't want to spend the time, energy, or money to accommodate anyone to register to vote. But in some ways, they kicked themselves in the butt because instead of doing motor voter, what did they do? They did same day registration. So now on the day of an election, you don't have to have registered to vote. You could literally walk into the election and register the same damn day, which in some ways is even more exciting than motor voter. Because a lot of people are suddenly like, wow, I am empowered to vote on this day. I'm not even registered, but you can go in and you can register on the same day. They thought they were doing an end run around motor voter. And in an interesting way, they gave a greater gift to people that wanted to exercise the franchise. But again, it's the headset of government. Does government want to actually produce results, or does government want to sort of throw out there and say all the burden is on you, when you and I both know we all come to the table with such different abilities to be able to access programs that should be available to us?
That's absolutely right, Arnie. Oh, and I mean, so much of government these days, in the age of, you know, reinventing government and shrinking the size of government, the idea is, essentially what gets done is we put a tax on people's time. We put a tax on their free time where they have to navigate these programs, things that they're entitled to, and work the system in ways that take time, effort, and resources in order to get the benefits to which they are supposed to be granted. And so what we're seeing here is an effort to say, you know what, we're the stewards of this government. We are the ones who are supposed to deliver these results. And it's important to us that these programs, when we put them together, that we actually execute them correctly with minimal frictions and removing as much of that tax on people's time as we possibly can. That's all this is, really. You know, the Biden administration obviously wants to do more than this. They didn't want to just fix the existing programs that give, to give borrowers a break. The truth is that we still keep accumulating student debt. Even with this $138 billion in debt forgiveness, if you look at outstanding federal student debt in 2021, federal, not overall, but federal student debt, which is most of it these days, it's all that's issued. It was about $1.2 trillion at the beginning of Biden's term. And today it's $1.55 trillion. So this has not reduced the outstanding amount of student debt. In fact, it's accumulating at just as rapid, if not a more rapid pace, even though we are engaging in these forgiveness programs that are actually working now. So, you know, it speaks to a broader problem with the way we finance higher education. You know, we have to come up with a system so that this is not so burdensome on students, where they leave their colleges with a mortgage at the beginning of their lives, which makes it hard for them to engage in the other normal business of financial accumulation throughout their lives. So, this is a bigger problem.
It's wonderful. Yeah, it's a terrible. But you know what I used to, I refer to student debt. I wrote a piece for the Boston Globe many, many years ago about student debt when I was writing as an op-ed writer, and the title of my piece was "Student Debt: The Anti-Dowry." And that's exactly what it is. It's the anti-dowry. And I just want to go to the, again, the idea of knowledge being power and being able to access these kinds of things. Many, many years ago, I was a poverty worker, David, and I remember doing a series of PSAs informing tenants what their rights were against landlords, about eviction, all these kinds of things. Right. All I was doing was sharing what the law said you had a right to do. Well, the landlords got furious, and they went to the agency and they went to the mayor and they said, look what Arnie Arneson is doing. Well, all Arnie Arneson was doing was sharing what the law was. Okay, the landlords knew, but they were abusing it, but the tenants didn't know. And so I called the landlords up and I said, you want to know what I'm doing? Why don't you come to one of the meetings? I'll teach you too. Okay, well, so you should know your rules and their rules.
And I think there's an important parallel to what has happened in student debt, actually, because the reason that the Biden administration felt the need to fix these programs is that activists, student debt activists, have been yelling about this for the last several administrations. They've been saying, look, you made a bargain with us. You put us into public service loan forgiveness. You said that if our colleges defrauded us, that we would be able to get relief. And you're not doing it. And we need you to do it. And so they pressured the Biden administration. They pressured the government. And finally, they found an administration that was willing to listen to those claims and act on them. And so it really was the work of people, you know, analogous to you that are responsible for this sea change in the federal government to actually, you know, honor their promises with as it relates to students.
And it also speaks to income inequality, because those with higher income, they hire their accountants, they hire their lawyers, they can squeeze every single dime out of the system and not pay so much in the way of their taxes. You know about the huge corporations that are paying nothing in taxes, despite the fact that they have enormous profits. Well, that's because the law is on the books. I mean, we may not like it, but the law is on the books. But for people who are at this stage where they don't have that access, where they can't figure it out, where they don't understand, or they've been denied and they don't know how to make the appeal, this actually creates finally the level playing field. That's what this does. All it says is the rich benefit from this. Well, guess what? So can the rest of us. The law is there. The money is there. Now they need to be obligated to it. Now, really, really quickly, I only have 2 minutes left, but I got to ask this question. I saw your most recent piece. The FTC is blocking a Kroger-Albertson merger on labor grounds. Really quickly, I was like blown away by the title. So in order to organize against these shopping giants, the whole point is if they merge, then it's going to be even more difficult to organize. I thought that was just an amazing angle.
Yeah, what's interesting is, and it's novel for a Federal Trade Commission lawsuit to try to block a merger on these grounds. Kroger and Albertson are both, first of all, they're the two largest grocery chains in the country, and they're both, most of their stores are covered by the UFCW. And typically what happens in bargaining is, you know, the UFCW in a particular region says, OK, the Kroger stores got this in their bargaining contract. We're going to ask for the same thing and we're going to go on strike if we don't get it. And we're going to say, go to Kroger, don't go to this Albertsons store. And if those two companies merge, that would disrupt that process, the ability for the unions to play off of one another. And so that is one of the key reasons, key rationales to block this. It's not the only rationale to block this merger, but it's one of the key ones that they're using in the lawsuit.
And I've never, again, when you're seeing suddenly the rise of union power and you're seeing this acceptance with 70% of the population, you suddenly see this as one of the arguments, you can't help but smile. Because it really is. It shouldn't be novel. In so many ways, it should be obvious, because that is where unions get their power. They get their power because they can point to another employer. But if that other employer doesn't exist, not only do they lose their power, they lose their jobs. They lose their jobs. And I think that's the other part of this story. David Dayen is the executive editor for the American Prospect. Anytime we grab him, we learn so much. Thank you so much for writing. And thank you so much for sharing that story, especially about student loans. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Arnie.
You're welcome. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
Let's reflect for a minute on the recent remarks of Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan.
Listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
Justice Kagan, during a public conversation at the Library of Congress, avoided saying anything directly relevant to any case before the court. But she did articulate decision-making principles and powerfully shared her perspective on the court discarding precedent. Justice Kagan said, "When the law flip-flops after change in personnel on the court, it doesn't look like law anymore. It looks like a form of politics." She continued, "And I think that's especially important for this Supreme Court at this time. Law should not look like a form of politics, where just because the composition of the court changes, a whole batch of legal rules change with it." Justice Kagan added, "When what was once a right is no longer a right because the court is different, I think that's very damaging to the court, very damaging to society." Justice Kagan did not mention any one of the dozens of examples where this Supreme Court has reversed or dramatically changed longstanding law, but as Adam Liptak wrote in the New York Times, it was a good bet that the court's 2022 decision overruling Roe versus Wade was among one of the ones on her mind.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Tuesday morning. I love KFF Health News. I love it because I'm always interested in healthcare. And as many of you know, having listened to my show for way too long, the invitation for me to get political was healthcare. All right. And I realized that if this was happening to me, imagine how many other people were being impacted by what I had seen happen when I was a poverty worker. And to a large extent, Shirley Chisholm, I remember having her speak. And she said, she was speaking to a bunch of 400 of us, 400 poverty workers, of which 98% of us were women. And she said, you have an obligation to get political. because you need to bring in the experiences you've had of the clientele you serve into the political process. Because without your voice, they may not understand what has to change, and you need to be there. And that was the year I ran for the legislature, and then the rest is history. So Elizabeth Rosenthal is the senior editor at KFF Health News. She is a former senior writer at the New York Times. She is the author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business, and How You Can Take It Back. She also practiced as an ER doctor before converting to journalism. I love your path, Elizabeth, and thank you so much for writing, because again, from being a doctor like me, being a poverty worker, I took that experience with me. You use it in the form of journalism, and I use it in the kind of policies I was attempting to either write or get passed. So in a lot of ways, I feel like I'm looking at a sort of a mirror image of myself, and I'm so grateful you exist.
But yeah, at some point, you realize that you can see one patient at a time in a broken system, or you can like go try and change the system. And that's what I've been doing for, you know, a very long time now, with little progress.
Well, we've both been trying to change the system. And even a little progress is something that at least gives us a sense that we have to get the goal. And I always tell everyone, I was just spoke at Harvard, and I had Bella Abzug's old office in 1997 when I was a fellow. And I use this line over and over again. I'll use it with you. And Bella's great quote was, you have to lose to win. And I have held on to that because that's what sustains me. And I think it's really important. I suspect it sustains you as well. But this piece so ticked me off, and I'm aware of it, but I didn't connect the dots the way you were able to do in your piece. It was also reprinted in The Atlantic. It's entitled GoFundMe Has Become a Healthcare Utility. We are a sick nation. We spend more money on healthcare than any country in the world, and yet we have millions of uninsured, underinsured, and persons bankrupt by illness. And now throw in this story, and the immorality of it should offend everyone. That's what I said. I read your piece, and I'm screaming. So welcome to the program, Elizabeth. And tell me what you learned about GoFundMe, because we're aware of it, but I'm not sure we're aware of its connection to healthcare, which to me is one of the most depressing stories I think I've ever read.
Yeah, I think, you know, I always think, and I think many people think of crowdsourcing as something, you know, its original intent was to fund for ideas and dreams. Like, I want to go on a post-graduation trip to build houses, or, you know, I knew someone who used GoFundMe to kayak around a lake in Siberia. You know, it was for that kind of thing. And now that the most common use of GoFundMe is for healthcare. And so what does that say about our system? It is, to me, a total indictment of everything we're doing wrong. And the most damning thing is perhaps that hospitals and financial aid officers are even suggesting, when patients can't pay, do a GoFundMe campaign. And I'm like, okay, you already got $28,000 from the insurer. This is in one case. So why don't you just say that's enough, rather than saying, oh, start a GoFundMe campaign for the rest? It's so offensive. And, you know, P.S., it doesn't work for most people. So yeah, that's what's so sad.
And you point out in your article, and this may not even be accurate, there probably is even more than that. There's an estimated a third of the funds raised on GoFundMe go for illness or injury. And you suspect it's an undercount. I agree with you. Then on top of that, the thing that also offended me is that it's based on your popularity. So, for example, Arne Arneson is notorious in New Hampshire. Good, bad, or indifferent, I'm notorious. I suspect if I put up a GoFundMe for some kind of an illness, I would probably be able to raise the money. I mean, there are enough people either love or hate me who would be willing to write a check, okay? Because my name is a known quantity. Right. But if my name was, you know, Arne Smith, and I had a terrible story to tell, the likelihood is I probably wouldn't raise $1,000, because I don't know people with deep pockets, or a lot of people would say, you know, I'm triaging, you're not on the top of my list. But as I'm reading this, so again, a lot of people even do this, but they never get to goal. And even if they get to goal, what they get to is maybe $1,000 of the $50,000, or the $2,000 of the, and then on top of that, remind my audience about the fact that this is a for-profit company.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Huh? Oh, my God. Throw that sucker in and you're really ticked off. Tell them a little bit about GoFundMe and its business model.
Well, it started as it started as a GoFundMe, but an idea as a for-profit company, but a kind of idealistic one. But in 2015, it was bought by private equity. So, you know, it's really who are we who's making money now? It's the company, as well as, you know, not the people who are needing the GoFundMes for healthcare. I think, as you said, you know, Mary Lou Retton, when she turned to crowdsourcing, got close to $500,000 when she was uninsured and had pneumonia. But, you know, one of the patients I interviewed who was not well off, went to GoFundMe because her baby needed an air ambulance ride. And, you know, she said it was a drop in the bucket because, and she was insured, you know, this was an out of network surprise bill before the law was passed. And she said, look, I'm not an influencer or anything. And so I didn't make the money. And yes, you know, I have, you know, friends, some friends with money. People know who I am. I could probably raise money, but it's people who most need it who won't raise money. And, you know, the official statistic is the average campaign earns 40% of its goal. From what I've seen, it's much less at this point. You know, it's a tiny fraction of what's needed.
But one thing I thought was so interesting in your article was it turned out that the woman, for example, who needed that helicopter, that plane ride, you know, and she was insured, it was just out of network or whatever, she was able to eventually negotiate with the hospital. And I think what's so interesting is that before the hospitals want you to negotiate, they say, why don't you try a GoFundMe? I mean, it's like if you really understood what would happen. I remember when my daughter was uninsured and she ended up having strep throat, and the hospital sent her a bill for $6,000, okay, for strep throat. This is in New Jersey. And I called the hospital. I said, really? What would Blue Cross Blue Shield be paying you?
Yeah.
And it was like maybe $1,100. I said, really? She's paying the $1,100. She's not paying you the $6. Yeah, I said, you want to fight me? Fight me. I said, but she's a, but I mean, but you have to have a mother like me. You know what I mean? And yet look what these companies do. They know what they can write off. They know, but the fact that they're even recommending GoFundMe is the height of immorality and greed. It really, really is.
Yeah. And in that case, you know, she was dealing with a sick 1-year-old, right? That should be her priority. And it was the air ambulance company that she was working with. And her insurer paid the air ambulance company its in-network rate of $28,000. And they still went after her for the balance. And yes, she negotiated that down to $5,000. But that's a lot of money. She was facing a whole lot of medical bills. These are not rich people. And, you know, they already got $28,000. Why not write off the $5,000 instead of saying, start a GoFundMe? You know, really? Are you that venal?
Well, and the fact that insurance companies and medical providers are even recommending it. I mean, how do they sleep at night? To me, it's just, and as you point out in your article, it really does continue to massage the grotesque inequality in our healthcare system. You know, the wealthy always get it, and they'll even get it with GoFundMe, and the poor won't get it because guess what? As you point out, they're not influencers and they don't have the name. In some ways, they have a greater desperation than the wealthy do. And yet, once again, you see this inequality in accessing to healthcare. And then you look at the things like bankruptcy and you look at all those things. And what kills me is, as you point out, you know, some people are insured and that's not a moat around you because right. There's still ways that you would end up having to pay so much. And I think in that way, it is so offensive. And I didn't see it in your article, but I need to ask if this is possible. So we mentioned that now private equity owns GoFundMe, and I made sure everybody knows that on my Facebook page. Anyway, what I'm kind of curious is, what's their cut? Do you know what the cut is for GoFundMe?
No, I don't know what their cut is. I know in the past, you know, they were criticized and then they lowered it to 3%.
Yeah.
But I think this was pre-private equity. So I don't know what their cut is, but, you know, at some level, my feeling is any cut is too much in this kind of thing.
Well, and begging is too much because that's what you're asking people to do. You're asking them to beg for something that should be their right, which is what I think is also so offensive to me is that and yet The story of the sale to the private equity is also interesting because you mentioned, and this is the part that blew my mind, you mentioned in your story that the CEO of GoFundMe, before they sold a significant amount to this private equity, had been recognized as one of the top sort of healthcare heroes in America in 2018. Right. Oh my God! I read that and I'm like, you're kidding me! They called him a healthcare hero because he figured out how to beg in such a way. I mean, we look at people that are like asking for a dollar as you go into a shopping mall and you're like, oh my God, isn't this pathetic? Look at those people. Well, in some ways, this is like just someone wearing a Brooks Brothers suit, basically accommodating people to do it on a higher end, but it's in some ways more grotesque.
Yeah. And you know, the funny thing is he was quite vocal as he was doing this, which I give him some credit for saying, you know, this health system sucks. It has to be improved.
Exactly.
This said, this is, you know, an indictment of our health system. The new CEO post, you know, private equity is more like, well, we help, you know, we want to help people help each other. And we're agnostic about what the source is. And you know, we do have people, we've seen people in our Bill of the Month project who were recommended to try GoFundMe for their healthcare debts. And one of them, a Black woman in Atlanta, said, I'm not going out hat in hand. That is too humiliating. Like, I'm not going to perpetuate that stereotype of, you know, what Black people are like. I can't do this. And, you know, I really admire her because it really does force people to kind of, throw out their financial situation, their dirty laundry, their, you know, it's kind of.
And their sense of integrity and self-worth. And Elizabeth, I'm surprised I'm going to go here, but listening to what you said about that Black woman saying, I'm not going to do this, because it just reinforces the stereotype. And there's a sense of pride and a sense of purpose. So when I ran for Congress, I was asking to, I had to fundraise 6 hours a day, 6 days a week. Okay. And I remember going home one night and sitting on the floor of the shower with the water pouring over my face and I'm crying because in a lot of ways, I think they were also trying to break me.
Yeah.
Because I was asking people I'd never met and I was being told what their interests were and what the ask should be. Like, was there a comma in the check as opposed to just asking for $50 or $100? And you were given, I mean, they would bring an egg timer over, Elizabeth. This is years ago, since 1996. And they would sit there with a little card and they would bring an egg timer over and there was the name, the ask, what the interest was and whatever. And they would then, as soon as the phone answered, they would turn the egg timer over and you had to do the ask in like 3.5 minutes. All right. And this was done to break the politician. It was not done to make sure you won. It was done to make sure that you understand how you won and who you owed. And as you're telling me that story of that Black woman who says, I don't want to do this, I get it. I didn't want to do that either. And there's something about how we've monetized everything. And it's not a good thing. It's a way to sort of really break your back and break your sense of self-worth. And I think that that's what this story is so about. And I'm just grateful you wrote it, but it's another reason why we have to change the healthcare system.
Yeah, and I think in some ways the saddest story is sometimes this happens because the last woman in my story is a woman named Carol Justice, and she had a bill for bariatric surgery that she couldn't pay. You know, she called the financial aid office dozens of times and they never called her back, right? And we've all had this experience. You don't like a bill. And now the strategy is just, we're not going to answer the phone or say, we'll get back to you and never do it. And so at some point, one of her counselors said, you better start a GoFundMe. And she raised $1,400. And when at some point, Carol drove to the hospital, basically planted herself in the financial aid office, said, how do I not qualify for financial aid? And the financial aid officer said, oh, you do. And then she said, well, can I have the $1,400 back? I'd like to refund the people who gave it to me for my GoFundMe. And they said, no, we'll keep that. You know, it's just really, I mean, you know.
But it's so wrong because think about it. So they never responded to her. So she had to take time off. in order to go to the hospital, to sit in front of the person who is going to be the decision maker, because we should have to, in some ways, make them uncomfortable. It's much easier to hang up than to basically push someone out the door. And as you said, oh, yes, you do qualify. Well, you could have answered that question 6 months ago, 5 months ago, but they didn't because they didn't answer. And the reason they don't answer is that that's a strategy.
Yeah,
that's a strategy. It's not like they don't want to answer. They're not answering because they think, oh, God, then the burden is on you. And once again, she did the GoFundMe, the $1,400. She was like moving heaven and earth. And in the end, she was always qualified.
Yeah.
But they didn't let her know.
And in our diagnosis debt series, we did a story that showed that many of the people who owed medical debt were in fact qualified for financial aid, but the hospital never told them. Like, you know, and that is, it's not easy, right? You make 20 phone calls, you fill out more forms than I had to fill out to get a mortgage to get financial aid. I mean, it's just roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. And,
so
you know, Americans are, they want to pay their bills. They, you know, they're scared of being sent to collections. It's a process of intimidation and unresponsiveness, and it's all in the name of making money.
It is. It is. So before we let you go, we were lucky enough to have David Dayan on from the American Prospect. And he was sharing a piece that I thought was just remarkable at the very, very end of our interview. We only spent a few minutes with him. And it was entitled FTC Blocks Kroger Albertsons Merger on, sit down, everyone, labor grounds. I'm like, whoa. The lawsuit alleges that a combined grocery giant would make collective bargaining more difficult. And I'm like, oh my God, I've never heard of this story angle, but I love it. And as I mentioned it to you, you said, but Arnie, this FTC has been amazing. It has done some really interesting and remarkable things. And you were talking about the FTC vis-a-vis what it's done in the area of healthcare. So we have a few minutes left. I would love to sort of take this slight detour because I think it's, this is a time when people are paying attention. Let's let them know.
Yeah, this is a great FTC, and it's an activist FTC using the laws that were always there, but giving them new interpretations. So a couple of things it's done in healthcare is it's blocked a bunch of hospital mergers on the grounds that, as we've all always known, you know, now when hospitals merge, it drives up prices and lowers quality. So they've said no. But the even more interesting thing they've done very recently is to start looking at drug patents and, you know, to say, hey, those aren't real patents. I mean, everyone knows that most drugs are covered by what's called patent thickets. Right. And they looked at recently at the patents that cover delivery devices. And they're like, those are not valid patents. And they've challenged those patents. They've gone to the drug makers of 10 devices and said, we're going to pull those. And that, you know, it's not going to bring down drug prices right away, but it's always been there. Everyone has always said these are bullshit patents. Sorry, I'm not sure if I can say
that. All right. That's all right. It is BS. But you know, and I don't know. I wish the FTC could also go after this, but I suspect it can't. I was looking at an article the other day about private equity purchasing things like nursing homes.
Yeah.
And what they showed was once a private equity company buys a nursing home, you notice something interesting. More people fall in the nursing home. More staffing gets reduced in the nursing home. And I just want to say something. I think I saw one of the numbers was they saw a 27% increase in falls. Yeah. Now, someone's like, well, what does that mean? I said, falling when you're that in a nursing home means you're dead. I mean, because falling is so, that's the one thing you so fear because it, you know, you can't survive what happens as a result. I mean, you might be able to survive, but the cost is going to go astronomical. So an invalid that's in the nursing home becomes even more debilitated. So the one thing you want to protect your patients from is falling. And to connect private venture into the percent of increase in falling. Oh my God. I guess I want to ask you this question. Elizabeth, how do we notice this? And how do we stop this? Because technically a nursing home has a fiduciary responsibility to protect the patients that basically are there. That's why you send your loved one there. But if we notice that ownership changes the nature of what happens in that nursing home, how do we not stop it, Elizabeth?
Well, one of the scarier things that actually came after my book, or I would have written a chapter about this, is that private equity owns huge amounts of our healthcare system. And what does private equity do? It seeks to increase profit and turn yes. around distressed things like chicken plants. But, you know, hospitals are not chicken processing plants. They need people. And, you know, a lot of hospitals, particularly rural hospitals that are in danger of closing, they have no other choice. And some private equity guy comes in and says, we'll save you, right? And what happens? They reduce staffing, they close the ER, they close the obstetrics unit. We did a story about one in Missouri that basically what they did is they drove the hospital into the ground, and then they often sell the real estate, which is what they're after often. So yeah. You know, it's a horrid development in our healthcare system. And, you know, you want to say market-driven healthcare, that's fine. But, you know, again, another damning thing or an indictment of our healthcare system is that in some cities, half of the GI practices are private equity owned. What are they going to do? They're going to become, you know, scoping for dollars. You know, right. They'll charge big, now they can't, yeah, one of the little wins, they can't charge big out-of-network fees, which was one of the private equity
deep pockets, and where they went for money, exactly.
You know, it was a strategy of some of the private equity groups to bill out-of-network, to give people surprise bills. They can't do that anymore. And in fact, some of the private equity staffing firms went under or had to kind of rearrange what they did, because surprise billing was their bread and butter, you know?
Oh, disgusting. I mean, but you know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of Medicare Advantage.
Oh,
because again, when you look at Medicare Advantage, and you, I mean, I remember historically that insurance companies did not want to insure old people. Okay, they didn't want to insure poor people and old people. Okay, well, that was their model. Their model was young and healthy, we're fine. We'll give the government the old people, we'll give the government the poor people, and they can basically pay for that. And then all of a sudden comes this concept called Medicare Advantage, and you're finding out that they make more money on Medicare Advantage than they do on any of their other insurance lines. And you're like, how is this possible? These are the old people. Like, what are they doing? What they're like heat seeking, you know, when it comes to money, they're finding it. And again, nobody knows a story, and they have an asset that you and I don't have, and that is that they can advertise. And if there's an advertisement that I absolutely hate, it's the advertisements for Medicare Advantage, because I want to take my shovel and throw it to the TV set, because what they're showing you, you know, young people walking along the beach and someone paying for your food and someone giving you a massage, like all of that sounds so incredibly delightful until you actually get sick. And that's when you suddenly realize it's not such a wonderful thing.
And one of the tragedies is that traditional Medicare is by law not allowed to advertise, right?
Yes.
So only the profit-taking versions of Medicare advertise. And like you said, it's like a bank giving you a toaster, you know, we'll give you money, we'll give you, you know, haircuts, we'll give you hearing aids. And, you know, in the end, they don't come through for a lot of the promises. And there's very little regulation.
Well, there's very little regulation, and I want to remind everyone the reason why they can, you know, pay for your food or give you a, you know, something at the YMCA or whatever it is, the gym benefit, is that that's peanuts.
Yeah.
Because when you're looking at the actual cost of healthcare, when you're looking at the cost of some drugs that are $40,000 a month, when you're looking at some of these things, they love giving away the tchotchke, because the tchotchke is absolutely, it's change in the sofa. All right. But when suddenly you want to access something that's really important, then you suddenly realize that they may deny you, or they may do something, or they won't cover it. And that's when you need healthcare, when you're sick.
Yeah.
And that's when they don't want to show up.
Yeah. And the other thing is, it's very hard to switch back from a Medicare Advantage plan to traditional Medicare. So they kind of trap people in this world of dysfunction and, you know, make money.
And again, the question is, we're all going to get sick, whether you're poor or you're rich. And now the question is, whether you're able to have access to healthcare based on your wealth is so wrong. And frankly, for society, it's wrong. I mean, it's hurting all of us. It's not just hurting the poor. It's hurting all of us, and we're spending so much of our money, and yet we're still so unhealthy. And I don't know, it's such a lose-lose. Elizabeth Rosenthal, thank you so much for writing for KFF News. It's a wonderful, wonderful service. Again, I want to remind you, she is the senior contributing editor at KFF Health News, a former senior writer at the New York Times, and she actually practiced as an ER doctor before converting to journalism. The piece we've been talking about, you can find it at the Atlantic Monthly or KFF Health News. GoFundMe has become what? The healthcare utility. Thank you again for doing this.
Thank you. It's so sad, isn't it?
It's terribly sad, but it's not sad that you joined me. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Shalom. You bet.